You're listening to Talk of the Nation Science Friday. I am Ira Flatow, and as I say before, for the rest of the hour, we're going to be talking about how stress can affect your health. You know, back in the day, way back in the day, say caveman times, the flight of or fight response was a good thing. You know, you were out there being a hunter-gatherer, a saber-tooth thingy or something comes along, jumps into your path. The stress hormone surge give you the extra push you need to hightail it back to the cave. Or maybe you were successful in your hunt, and as you sit enjoying the fruits of your labors, your neighbor caveman comes over and tries to grab your drumstick. Again, that fight-or-flight response kicks in, a pretty useful mechanism. And even though life in caveman times might have been stressful, you probably didn't live long enough to die from stress-related diseases like heart attacks or strokes. So as we evolve beyond hunter-gatherer times, why hasn't our stress response? Why is stress still killing us in very many ways? And here to talk about stress and what it is doing to us is Robert Sapolsky, is author of Why Zebras Don't Get Ulcers. It's now in its third edition, published by Henry Holt. He's a research associate at the Institute of Primate Research at the National Museum of Kenya and a professor of biology and neurology at Stanford University in California. Welcome, Dr. Sapolsky.
Thanks. Thanks for having me here.
The name of your book, Why is it that zebras don't get ulcers?
Well, of course, it turns out they get ulcers in certain circumstances, but the basic song and dance is one along the lines that you just brought up. Zebras don't worry about mortgages. Zebras don't worry about the ozone layer thinning out. Zebras don't worry about existential angst. They worry if a lion is coming after them right now. Your basic mammal out there, for them, what stress is about is 3 minutes of screaming terror, after which they're over with or the event's over with. And sort of the key contrast is when you look at a sophisticated primate like we are, we've got the capacity to be stressed chronically, not because predators are chasing us, but for reasons of purely psychological or social malaise. And that's not what the stress response evolved for.
Yeah, so we're keeping it long term. Instead of getting rid of the stress, we're holding on to it because the stress doesn't mean that go away, or we just psychologically can't deal with it.
Yep, exactly.
Yeah. Is this something that's, you know, on the increase? We've been seeing more and more stories just this week about how stress in the workplace is just killing everybody.
Well, it's clear that stress-related disease is really at the center of what we worry about in health these days. Not a whole lot of us are dealing with serious problems with scarlet fever or malaria or dengue fever or things like that. We're not normal mammals. Mm-hmm. That's not to say that we have more stressful lives. You know, I would take traffic jams any day over being a medieval peasant or some farmer in the developing world. It's not that we have more stressful lives, but it's that we live well enough and long enough that we can finally pay the price in terms of slow degenerative diseases. Hmm. We could finally pay the price for our lifestyles that have an awful lot of this psychosocial stress.
Do we as Westerners have more stress than other cultures? And do we handle it differently?
We definitely don't have more when you look at people in a, quote, more real part of the world. A downturn in the economy and pink slip showing up is nothing compared to the locusts wiping out your harvest. Mm-hmm. Our stressors are much more, again, sustainedly social and psychological. We sure deal with them differently, though, and we've got a sort of American culture built around large amounts of pressure, large amounts of productivity, a lot less social connectiveness than is normal for your basic run-of-the-mill primate, let alone your basic human. We have a psychologically very stressful world.
Do you think that we're in the process of naturally selecting people who can deal with stress since now, you know, it's hurting people?
In a funny way, yes, for certain stretches of time. I mean, if you define certain diseases, certain psychiatric disorders, as disorders of people who don't deal with stress very well, we absolutely see that happening. Mm-hmm. For example, you could think about an anxiety disorder as being a problem where somebody sees stressors that other people simply don't. You have a mindset that you always have to be vigilant. You always have to have your back covered. You always constant mobilization of, as it turns out, one part of the stress response. Or in some ways, at the other extreme, depression can be thought of as a disorder where somebody who could potentially cope with a stressful challenge decides they can't because they're hopeless, they're helpless. And again, chronic activation often of another component of the stress response. What we see is diseases like depression and anxiety, you do pay a price on the average medically increased risk of a number of diseases, decreased life expectancy in some ways. Aha, so you guess, let's come back 100,000 years from now and the only folks surviving will be the descendants of the most anxiety-proof, depression-proof, type A-proof people around there.
Right.
But what you wind up getting every now and then is some huge disaster going in the opposite direction where the only people who are going to survive have these profiles. And the example that always comes to mind for me, you know, just given my own cultural background, is I sure hope if I was sitting in Berlin in 1933, I wouldn't have sat there and said, geez, these things blow over, people are people, we'll all get along, and instead saying, no, this is not right. And a circumstance like that, only the most anxious wind up surviving.
Is there something predictable and observable that goes on in your brain when you're under stress? Tell us about the chemistry that happens there.
Well, it turns out, you know, the brain is your master endocrine organ, which is sort of an odd concept that a lot of people are still assimilating. Your brain directly or indirectly runs your whole stress response, all the hormones, adrenaline, and there's 11 others that are released. Your brain is central to it, and what you see with a disturbing and arousing, a challenging circumstance, there's whole areas of your brain that activate arousal, alertness, pathways that turn on these stress hormones, other pathways that turn off more long-term optimistic aspects of physiology. Your brain mobilizes very dramatically in response to stress.
And what kinds of chemicals are released and what kinds of reactions happen? Specifically,
you know, if you had to round up sort of the two most critical players, the first would be, of course, adrenaline. American version, it's called epinephrine, comes out of your adrenal glands, and that's the 1 second after the scary near accident, your stomach clutching. That's the effects of epinephrine, adrenaline within seconds. The other workhorse is another hormone that comes out of the adrenal glands, and these are steroid hormones called glucocorticoids. And of a lot of significance, lots of us will be familiar with synthetic versions of these, hydrocortisone, prednisone. These are used all the time in clinical medicine. Now, what these hormones and the other hormones of the stress response do is exactly what you'd want them to be doing if all stress consisted of was a short-term physical crisis. Mm-hmm. They mobilize energy for your thigh muscles or whatever exercising muscles you have. Your cardiovascular tone increases to deliver that energy. You shut down growth, you shut down reproduction, you shut down all sorts of long-term projects, you know, thicken your uterine walls some other time, the predator's coming right now, that kind of logic. You sharpen cognition, you blunt pain perception. All of this is perfect if stress is short-term physical crises. It's not till you get to primates and their capacity to have these really sustained psychosocial stressors, these same hormones, if you secrete them chronically, metabolic diseases, stress-induced hypertension, reproductive disorders, growth disorders, a lot of neurological implications, suppression of the immune system. Collectively, you get this punchline, you don't want to turn the stress response on too often, too long for purely psychological reasons.
Does it cause any brain damage over the long period?
Well, this is a very hot subject in the field these days. This is what my lab has sort of spent its last 20 years on, looking at the fact that those glucocorticoid hormones can damage a class of neurons in a part of the brain, and these are some of most people's favorite neurons because they're central to learning and memory, a part of the brain called the hippocampus. And this is the part of the brain, for example, that's damaged in Alzheimer's disease. And what we've known for years is lots of these hormones can do a whole bunch of bad things to hippocampal neurons. What's remained unclear is how relevant is this to the human hippocampus? Mm-hmm. And two very disturbing literatures in recent years, ones that are still open to a lot of interpretation, but at least raise some red flags. First, history of people with severe stressors, people with PTSD, post-traumatic stress disorder, combat vets, childhood abuse, and a whole literature now showing atrophy of the hippocampus, only the hippocampus. In some of these studies, the more extreme the stressful history, the more hippocampal atrophy, the more memory loss. The big debate in that literature these days is, does the stress and the post-stress period lead to atrophy of the hippocampus, or does a small hippocampus set you up for PTSD? Jury's still out on that one. The other syndrome is even more worrisome because it's relevant, probably 10, 20% of the population, who winds up having a major clinical depression at some point or other. And as I was saying, this is the textbook stress-related disease of psychiatry. It involves elevated levels of those glucocorticoids in lots of cases, and the literature now just coming out showing big-time long-term depression, atrophy of the hippocampus, only the hippocampus. The more prolonged the depression history, the more atrophy, the more memory problems. Not a good sign either.
Is that short-term memory, long-term memory? I mean, we hear that stress can affect your memory and you just forget to do things.
It's the type of memory the hippocampus specializes in is a subtype called explicit declarative memory. You know something and you know that you know something. It's not the reflexive tennis backhand.
It's the Jeopardy answer question.
Exactly, yes. So forget about that Jeopardy career if you don't have a hippocampus.
I want a Jeopardy senior version where you get 20 minutes to answer each question. Give me a few minutes, you know, because we're all at that age. But this is interesting stuff about the neuronal problems that this creates. I saw there was a paper out in Nature Neuroscience last month about how it was called Restructuring the Neuronal Stress Response with Anti-Glucocorticoid Gene Delivery. Gene therapy that might work?
Yes. It's one of those like softballs you've just lobbed up to me. Yes, this was actually a paper from my own lab. Mm-hmm. And this is not an approach that's going to be at the neighborhood grocer very soon. But this was built around the fact that those glucocorticoid hormones, steroid hormones, the way they work is they bind to a receptor in cells, a glucocorticoid receptor, built around the fact that these glucocorticoid steroids structurally are very close to another class of steroids, estrogens. And estrogens turn out to do fabulous things in the nervous system, all sorts of good effects amid a huge incendiary debate these days about estrogen and heart disease. But they tend to do some very good things in the nervous system, and estrogen acts through an estrogen receptor. So what we did was some molecular tinkering and basically built ourselves an artificial gene that was half of the gene for a glucocorticoid receptor, half of the gene for an estrogen receptor. And what you wind up getting is a receptor which binds glucocorticoids in hippocampal neurons during stress, but then acts as if it bound estrogen. So you block the bad effects of the stressful glucocorticoid hormones, and for free, you turn it into these protective estrogenic effects. And we're getting some nice, encouraging results with that.
Well, according to your paper, you reversed damage by 63%. Wow.
Yep. This was with a rat model of a neurological disease. We're also showing now that you can improve learning and memory during stress in these animals. As you said, normal version stress impairs aspects of cognition, turn those glucocorticoid effects into estrogenic ones, and suddenly stress makes memory get better in some of these rats. But again, this is not at anything related remotely to clinical usage yet.
1-800-989-8255 is our number. We're talking about stress this hour with Robert Sapolsky, author of Why Zebras Don't Get Ulcers, a terrific read. And this is, I mean, for a stressed out person like me, this is eye-opening. We're going to get to talking about what to do about stress on Talk of the Nation Science Friday from NPR News. And one of the things you mentioned in your book is that we can learn something from the apes and baboons and monkeys about how they handle stress.
You can learn from some of them, and some of them you mostly learn do not act like this guy. A whole literature by now looks at who gets stress-related diseases. What does it have to do with your personality? What does it have to do with your place in society? What does it have to do with how someone with that place gets treated in your society? And some of these studies, remarkably enough, have involved non-human primates. And I've done some of this work for the last 26 years. I spent parts of my summer studying baboons in East Africa. I actually just got back a week ago looking at those issues. And what you get are, at first pass, some absolutely obvious predictable answers, but with some subtle twist to them. What you wind up seeing is, if you're a baboon running around the savannas of East Africa, if you got a choice in the matter, you don't want to be a low-ranking baboon. You've got more physical stress, you've got more psychological stress, less control, less predictability, less outlets, and, as it turns out, more physiological, more disease markers of stress. So initially, it looks like this is one big blowout social Darwinist vote for being successful and high-ranking and compete and win and all of that. That turns out to be valid with these baboons, but it turns out even more important than your social rank are aspects of personality. Independent of your rank, do you have social affiliation, social support? It's a miserable day. Do you have somebody who grooms you? Independent of rank, can you tell the difference between a big thing and a little thing? What's a big thing? Some guy is threatening you in your face from a foot away. What's a little thing? The same guy is taking a nap at the other side of the field. Can you tell the difference? And what you wind up seeing is vast differences in stress physiology in these baboons, depending on what personality styles they have. Mm-hmm. Now, an important feature of that is you see some of those exact same personality styles in people and some of the same disease outcomes. But the problem with people is different personalities, different aspects of social rank, different aspects of stress, and people wind up having different rates of eating to excess and smoking and drinking too much and not getting Baboons don't smoke, they don't drink, they all get the same exercise, they don't lie on the questionnaires. They have all of those things controlled for, and if you see the exact same personality disease relationships in these guys, you've just ruled out a whole lot of the confounds.
But what about relieving stress? How important is it to find, you know, you say we're all in a society with stress, but it seems to me how you deal with it is much more, you know, relevant than having the stress.
For the sort of stressors that probably plague most of us, which is to say sort of middle-class neuroses, if you're stressed because, say, you've got terminal cancer or you're homeless or you're a refugee, basically not a whole lot of stress management is going to be relevant. And somebody preaching to you about how just with the right outlook and the right personality and the right cheerful mantra chanted to yourself, you can turn hell into heaven, kind of, that's fatuous. That's ultimately offensive. There's whole realms in which this sort of mind-body interface doesn't make a dent. And one has to be very, I think, on guard for realms in which people may be making rather good livings out of selling far too much power for stress intervention in the realm of the real disastrous stressors that fortunately only a subset of us get. But when you get to the miseries that most of us find to be dominating our lives, the ones where with a little perspective we realize this is not such a big thing, yes, the physiology of the responses are important, but if anything, the psychological interpretations are far more powerful.
All right, we're going to come back and talk lots more about this with Robert Sapolsky, author of Why Zebras Don't Get Ulcers, and take your phone calls and maybe relieve a little stress this hour. So stay with us. We'll be right back. You're listening to Talk of the Nation Science Friday. I am Ira Flato. We're talking this hour about stress with my guest, Robert Sapolsky, who is the author of Why Zebras Don't Get Ulcers. No, they don't. Now in its third edition, published by Henry Holt, he is a research associate at the Institute of Primate Research at the National Museum of Kenya and a professor of biology and of neurology at Stanford University in Stanford, California. Our number 1-800-989-8255. Let's go to the phones and talk to Michael in Charlotte, North Carolina. Hi, Michael.
Hi, how are you?
Fine.
My question is perhaps oversimplistic, but I was wondering if the types of exercise that we as humans could get could affect our stress reduction. For instance, zebras can run away from a threat. Would running, jogging, or something like the large muscle group use perhaps be more effective in helping to reduce stress?
Not a simplistic question at all. That's a lot of people spending a lot of time trying to figure out what's the optimal exercise programs. What you wind up seeing is, you know, it's logical that when you are all tensed up, all stressed, that muscle exertion, exercise makes a lot of us feel better. Again, what the stress response is about physiologically is getting you all set to sprint across the savanna, and now you're doing the same thing because you're stuck in some meeting having to, you know, laugh at your boss's jokes or whatever. What you wind up seeing is exercise and use of large muscle groups can be very stress reducing. In general, with a couple of caveats, the first one being aerobic exercise works a whole lot better than anaerobic, and the other one seems totally obvious once it's stated, which is you have to actually like exercising. Involuntary exercise is an amazing stressor, so it's got to feel like it's stress-reducing.
Take another lap, in other words. It's incredibly, yes. Was incredibly stressful for me in high school. All right, thanks, thanks, Michael.
Thank you, sir.
What about laughter? We hear about the power of laughter, and, you know, even have phrases, you know, laugh to break the tension. Is laughter, has been, and, you know, we used to hear about just flexing the muscles on your face would release endorphins in your body. Has anything come of that?
Oh, it's definitely still in the list of things you should try to do. It's not terribly well studied. Mm-hmm. The lab rat models of laughter are very difficult to work with. But, you know, that certainly fits within the realm, both because of the muscular aspects of what you're doing and laughing, the oxygenation, but also because of the mindset that's involved in finding something humorous. Often that's a segue to finding some disaster to be less disastrous.
Yeah, we know of people who thrive on stress and don't seem to, you know, to be affected by it. What secret do they have?
You know, that's a real central puzzle, because virtually by definition, you get a whole bunch of people together, and whatever it is that ulcerates you into a puddle, somebody else there, that counts as their favorite hobby. We've got enormous individual variation. Of course, the issue winds up being, why is it for some people their notion of a stressful hobby is, you know, a strenuous Audubon Society walk, and for somebody else it's, you know, signing up for that mercenary stint. Enormous variation in that realm. What you generally wind up seeing is people who would be categorized more as risk-taking, impulsive, sensation-seeking. There's a whole personality cluster that goes with that. If one had to guess what's going on, it has to do with the really interesting thing that stress does to your brain chemistry. And it's got to do with a neurotransmitter or brain chemical called dopamine. Dopamine is all about pleasure in one part of the brain. It's all about the anticipation of pleasure. Cocaine works on these dopamine pathways. And awful, sustained, chronic stress depletes that pathway of dopamine working properly. Mm-hmm. And you wind up with a circumstance, which makes perfect sense, of chronic stress. You're not feeling a whole lot of pleasure. Depression, anhedonia, inability to feel pleasure. The astonishing finding is short-term mild stress releases dopamine. It stimulates the system. What you wind up getting is short-term mild stress feels fabulous. And this is obvious. We love stress. We love when it's the right amount. We pay good money for it. What's the right amount of stress? Transient and not all that severe. We call it stimulation.
Right.
What you wind up seeing is, once again, enormous variability in how readily stress hormones release dopamine in this pathway. And the best guess for what an adrenaline junkie is about, someone who's just addictively having to push that envelope, is this is someone where their dopamine levels may be a little bit on the low side to begin with. Mm-hmm. And you get some nice transient stressor, which boosts up dopamine, you feel great, and it goes back down afterward to a little bit lower than where it started. Wait, so what's the only solution? Yeah. Do it again, do it again, do it again.
But you're able, but there's the point that as I see it, you know, there are people who go on these roller coasters over and over again, but they can get off it when they want to. If they had to go on it for 24 hours a day, it would not become a pleasurable item anymore. It would be something very stressful. And they've lost the ability to control when they can stop and start that stress.
Yep, this stuff becomes potentially very addictive for a subset of people. And again, what counts as that stressful challenge is tremendously variable. But all of us love stress. Our goal is not to have a stress-free life. Mm-hmm. And it's perfectly clear from child development to gerontology that, you know, you want to get stress in someone's life, but just the right amount.
But the point I'm saying is that there isn't control something part of this. That you can control the event, and then it's not, you know, it's a pleasurable event. But when you can't control it, then the stress turns into something unpleasurable and something you don't want.
Great. Okay. Control is real central to the whole thing. Because control, the downside of it is it's all about what psychological stress is built on. Loss of control for the same exact physical stressor. If you feel like you've got control over the circumstances, your physiology is going to be much better. Control is a bad thing. I'm sorry, lack of control is a bad thing. Stress management, how to get control in your life, et cetera, et cetera. Meanwhile, over at the other end, analyzing what is it that makes humor humorous? What is it that makes tickling, what it does to people, what is it that makes all sorts of things stimulating, is you give away a certain amount of control. Mm-hmm. So when is control a good thing? When is it a bad thing? And I think the general punchline winds up being that if the loss of control is occurring in a context that overall feels malevolent, that's going to be incredibly stressful. Mm-hmm. And if the loss of control instead is occurring in an environment where you basically feel safe, the roller coaster is going to be scary and all of that, but you're fairly confident it's not going to kill you. In that setting, giving away a little bit of the control is wonderfully mm-hmm. stimulating. Mm-hmm.
Let's go to Tucson, Arizona. Moji, hi, welcome to Science Friday.
Hi, thank you for taking my call. I'm a psychologist turned full-time human rights activist and peace activist, and I'm a poet, and I have an ulcer. So
you're reading too much of the newspapers lately.
Well, no, there is a life. There is a world that is falling apart. Yeah. But the point I'd like to make is that the kind of stress responses stresses that we have as, so to speak, civilized higher primates are as your speaker has pointed out aptly, are in the psychosocial realm. Therefore, as consciousness has developed, we have evolved in those realms and have developed stress-reducing responses, such as developing a justice, so-called justice system, developing art, developing poetry, developing a whole set of adaptation mechanisms that are in the psychological and social realms. So to look at our physiology and to ponder the question, how come we haven't, quote-unquote, evolved in the physiological realm, neglects that we have consciousness. I believe that the source of most of our stress is that we live in an extremely lopsided, unjust world, and then we also haven't developed this appropriate psychosocial adaptations to the communication and transportation revolutions that has made us able to, you know, go from one place to another and or be in communication instantly. And we just haven't developed, our wisdom hasn't caught up with our ability to control nature in the form of developing technologies.
Mm-hmm. Let me just jump in and remind everybody that this is Talk of the Nation Science Friday from NPR News. Robert Sapolsky, you want to answer that? Go ahead.
Yeah, I would agree completely with that analysis. It winds up being a double-edged sword. We can do things over space and time that no other creature can out there, and that's got good and bad sides when it comes to stress. You know, for lots of animals out there, physical stress is about somebody has slashed you with their canines, and social support is about somebody grooms you or somebody nuzzles you. And we, on the other hand, can have stress built around somebody has pushed a button and miles away a smart missile lands somewhere. Aggression is far more distant and emotionally detached. But at the same time, we don't just get comforted and have our stressors reduced by somebody grooming us. We can get a phone call from the other side of the planet. So our technology, you know, has plus and minus sides in terms of the stressors it creates, but also the opportunities for stress management.
Thank you, Moji. Let's talk about some of those opportunities for stress management. Are there any simple remedies, exercises, you know, mental, physical exercises you would recommend for all of us who are not in the unfortunate situation where we're you know, dependent on other people for our living, or we're not dealing with diseases, things like that, but just the normal everyday stresses of our jobs and our work and our life?
Well, the carefully hedged answer is maybe.
Maybe.
You know, because there's a bunch of very simple interventions, yeah, and these are ones that we find extremely difficult to implement, being humans and going about things the way we do. All sorts of stress management interventions, ranging from meditation to prayer to aerobic exercise to a whole bunch of these, do wonders psychologically, physiologically. Social support is extremely medically protective. Religiosity turns out to be, in some domains as well, in some areas, a highly controversial subject. But what you wind up getting are a bunch of rules for it, which is you can't do your stress management on the weekend. You can't do your stress management while you're on hold on the phone for 30 seconds. You've got to set time out. You've got to do it virtually daily. And that's where the often very simple interventions wind up being so hard for us, because we're all incredibly good at knowing exactly what we need to do to improve our lives starting tomorrow. And yeah, we all have this problem of getting a hold of something and trying to do something in the present. These interventions work, but often the mere grabbing hold of your circumstances enough to do something on a daily basis, to say no to some of the things that can't be said no to, you're 80% of the way there already.
You're basically saying we need a lifestyle change if we want to really be serious about this.
To some extent, and we've got an awful lot of insight as to how to live more healthfully, and all sorts of us with the Western lifestyle type diseases running rampant if we have, can nonetheless give you a fairly plausible list of how to lead a healthier life, and it's a very hard thing for us to do. The temptation of the moment and the present is very strong.
Are things in our diet stressful for us?
You know, one could go off on some screed about westernized diet,
caffeine,
high-tech
like
food,
you know,
and, you know, use of those stimulants, absolutely. And that's built around the fact that we get far less sleep than normal mammals do and normal primates and even normal humans do. And we have to pharmacologically do something about that a lot of the time. Yeah, that's definitely a realm where that's a problem we solve with medication far too often rather than with a change in lifestyle.
Dr. Sapolsky, I want to thank you very much for taking time to talk with us. Robert,
sure, thank you.
You're welcome. Is the author of Why Zebras Don't Get Ulcers. As I say, this is a great book. If you want to, everything you wanted to know about stress, it'll be up on our website if you want to find a link to it. He's a research associate at an Institute of Primate Research at the National Museum of Kenya, professor of biology and neurology at Stanford University in California. Thanks again for taking time to talk with us. Kevin Wade is our technical director. Our audio engineer is our Matt Galick. Paul Masiello and Rigo Cardi in New York, and Mark Whalen in Stanford, California. Greg Smith composed our theme music, and we had help today from NPR librarians Key Molesky and Alphonse Finn. If you have comments or questions, you can write to us at Science Friday, 55 West 45th Street, 4th floor, New York, New York, 10036. You can also surf over to our website at sciencefriday.com. Leave us email there. Also listen to back editions of Science Friday. And now as the school year gets cranked up, Science Friday's Kids Connection, free curricula based on the topics we talk about in science here on Science Friday. For schools, teachers, students, you can download it and use it to teach some of the subjects we talk about here on Science Friday. Have a great weekend. We'll see you next week. I'm Ira Flatow in New York.